Now, why do we need a high priest? There's a so what factor in Hebrews, isn't there? You read all these very interesting things and you think, so what? Why are we being told this? This is all tied into a system of worship that God gave to the Jews more than 2,000 years ago, which stopped being relevant 2,000 years ago. Why do we need to be interested now? What is this passage going to teach us? Well, it's perhaps helpful to begin by thinking that there are situations we're already familiar with in our lives, in our society, in our modern world, where we need a special person to represent us. After all, if you had a court case, and particularly if it went into a higher court, you would need a competent and experienced lawyer to put your case. You could go yourself, but you probably wouldn't do much of a job of it. You want somebody who knew what they were doing. Or if you wanted to lobby the government in Parliament, you need to persuade your MP to put your case for you. You can't just go along to the gallery and call out. They'll take you out. You need somebody to represent you, to speak for you in those situations. And this passage in Hebrews is telling us that we need a special representative before God. In the Old Testament, there was a succession of men who were high priests. In their time, they were appointed, they became high priests, and were high priests until they died. And then the next relative in the line of Aaron took it on. But there is still a high priest, and that is Christ. And he is high priest forever. And this Hebrews tells us that he is just like those high priests of the Old Testament, but he is much better in every way. Once again, it's one of these arguments in Hebrews from the lesser to the greater. You're familiar with this that God gave you in the past. Now God has given you something greater. It wasn't that the past was bad, but this is better. This is the ultimate. This is what God has always been working towards, and it's Christ. He's much better in every way. He is able to do for us everything we could possibly need and more besides. So what are the characteristics of Christ's priesthood as we find it in this passage? Firstly, we find that priesthood is a victorious priesthood, a victorious priesthood. We've been thinking, we've been thinking the last two or three sermons about chapter 3 and most of chapter 4, where the writer of the Hebrews is giving a warning against unbelief. But that was a by the way. There was something he was teaching about, and he said, by the way, and then said, in effect, don't fall away like people did in the past. Don't give up. You know, that this is the truth. You need to stick with it. But in the passage we're looking at, he's come back to where he started. And so this passage links back to chapter 2 and verse 17, where we find that there is a merciful and faithful high priest who made atonement for the sins of the people. A merciful and faithful high priest who made atonement for the sins of the people. And in that passage in chapter 2, we find out that Jesus, that sums up a number of things, that he brought many sons to glory as the author of salvation, that he makes his people holy like himself, that he has destroyed the power of the devil and freed us from slavery. And in doing all these things in mercy, in faithfulness to his Father's will and calling, he has made atonement for our sins and brought us to himself. A victory over sin, a victory over the devil, a victory over everything that had gone wrong, and a victory that established God's will and God's eternal people, God's eternal family. And so he has now gone through the heavens, we read in our passage. He has died for sins, offered that sacrifice. He has now risen and ascended. And so our writer reminds us of these things and says that this is our high priest. He has done all these things in the past. He has achieved a victory. He is a victorious priest. And then he says, therefore, hold firmly to the faith we profess. He's just been warning us against going away, letting loose the grip. They were looking back at the past and saying, well, maybe it was better then. And he's been warning us about doing that and the danger of doing it. And now he says and reminds us, hold firmly to the faith. Faith in his atonement. This great high priest has done what no previous high priest could do. So have faith in him. The high priest could only offer sacrifices for the people, particularly one sacrifice every year. But even that didn't take away sin. It was only ever a picture of what Jesus was going to do. And when Jesus offered himself as the sacrifice for sin on the cross, it replaced all those sacrifices with one effective sacrifice, the victorious priest. So hold firmly to our faith in him. So there is a victorious priesthood, and secondly, there is a compassionate priesthood. It is a compassionate priesthood. Because as the writer says in verse 15, we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet was without sin. This great high priest can sympathize. He was tempted in every way and without sin. That doesn't mean to say he was tempted in every single possible conceivable way. For example, he wasn't tempted to look at pornography on the internet because the internet didn't exist. There are temptations in our day we can say, well, Jesus wasn't tempted to do that. Well, of course not. And there were temptations in the society then that may not be present now. But he was tempted in all kinds of ways. Every category of temptation Jesus underwent. And if we think through it, what are temptations we face? We would be able to say, if we knew all of Jesus' life, not just what's recorded in the Bible, but all the detail that wasn't put in there, he would have been tempted, he was tempted in every kind of way. Let's just look briefly at his temptations in the desert, which should have given illustration of the kind of thing he underwent. I've highlighted Luke chapter 4, that passage for us. And there are three temptations, you remember, that the devil brought to him when he came. Firstly, a temptation to put his natural desire, his hunger, above God's will. If you're the Son of God, tell this stone to become bread. He had come to the wilderness to pray and fast. And the devil tempted him to use his power in an inappropriate way just to give himself food. And yet he was able to say no to that and put his desires aside and behind God's will. He was tempted to pride. The devil said, I will give you the kingdoms of the world if you worship me. A temptation to aggrandize himself. And yet he repelled that temptation, knowing that God had everything in his hand. The Father had everything to give. And it wasn't for the Son to take it from the devil or from anyone else. And there was a temptation to human pride, and he repelled it. And a temptation not to show faith in the Father. You remember that the devil encouraged him to throw himself down from the temple and dare his Father to send angels to miraculously bear him up and stop him killing himself on the ground. It sounds like it's an encouragement to faith, doesn't it? Relying on God. But it's putting God on trial and asking God to do something he hasn't promised to do. And a very stupid thing, unnecessary thing. And actually shows a lack of faith in the Father, a lack of faith in the Father's will. And Jesus repelled that temptation. He was tempted through his disciples. Remember Simon Peter saying to him that he wouldn't know, Lord, you won't go to the cross, you won't suffer. And the Lord repelled that. And he speaks at other times of trials that he underwent to develop his ministry and to be ready for his suffering on the cross. He was tempted in every way, yet without sin. Beyond that, he is able to represent us not just because he can sympathize with us, but he can represent us because he is truly man, and he's able to deal gently with us as he understands our weakness. Do you notice that as we read through? A high priest is a man like us, and he's able to deal gently. And those things are true of Jesus too, because he became man and lived a human life, and because he knows our weakness and limitations, because he took them on himself, other than sinning, he's able to deal gently with us. That phrase, dealing gently, reminded me of this verse in Matthew on the screen, Matthew 12, verse 20, a prophecy of Isaiah, which Matthew says is fulfilled in Jesus. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smouldering wick he will not snuff out. In other words, when he encounters weak people who are reaching out to God and are hanging on in their faith, he doesn't discard the bruised reed and say, well, it's not perfect, do away with it. He doesn't break it. He protects it. And if a wick is smouldering so that it's almost burnt out and it's just smoke and not much there, he doesn't snuff it out and say, oh, well, there's not much there. He builds it up. He brings fuel. He deals gently with us to fan the wick into flame, to strengthen the bruised reed. And he is able to do that because he understands us. And he understands us so well because he is man. Now, the writer's not saying that if he hadn't become man, he couldn't understand us. Or the Father can't understand us, but Jesus can. That's not really what he's trying to say. But what he's saying is that Jesus' experience as a man, his life as a man, gives him a different kind of understanding. He's been through an experience that enriched the understanding he already had. And importantly, we can be confident that he understands. There's no way of saying, well, God doesn't know how I feel. God doesn't know my life. God doesn't know what it's like to be a human being. Because he does. He was. He is. He remains human. He has been through it all. He sympathizes. He represents us. And he deals gently. And so he's a very highly qualified high priest, isn't he? As we look through these, what we might think of as the human qualifications for a high priest from the past, and we compare Jesus, he is very highly qualified to be our high priest. And as our high priest, he actively ministers to our ongoing needs. We read in verse 16 that he dispenses mercy and grace. He renews forgiveness of our sin as we confess it. He refreshes the heart, and it shows mercy in other ways. And brings grace, gifts, and support and help in time of need, comfort, encouragement, energy, at different times. Whatever it is that we need, he brings it. We can look back in our lives and each other's lives within the church family and see how Christ has brought a tremendous amount of help for us, for people in dire straits, really difficult situations. Going through things that seem impossible to deal with, and yet Christ brings a help and a grace, an ability to see God's purpose in it, even though no human being can work it out on their own. A peace in the heart when everything has gone wrong, and he ministers grace in that way. And yet he brings a small help to us every day. He brings us refreshment. We perhaps don't realize it or don't think upon it. Times when suddenly we, you know, even though perhaps those little times we seem to perk up during the day, we think of it as a normal thing. But I think that's Christ ministering grace to us in very small ways that we need. Ministering to our minds as we think about things and pray and reflect. Grace in small ways. He meets our needs. But the writer says there is a mechanism. If we want to receive this grace and mercy, it comes in a particular way. I've, like Tony and possibly others, have a Kindle book reader, which is now a fixture in my bag on the way to work, and I'm reading all kinds of books and have all kinds of things on there. And lots of the books on the through Kindle are free. Lots of older novels you get for nothing. It's great. I'm reading quite a lot of them. But you have to do something to get the book. You have to go onto the Amazon website and download the novel. It's not hard. It doesn't cost anything. It just takes a little bit of time, but you've got to do it. There's a mechanism for getting the free book. And it's the same here. If we look at verse 16, the great high priest dispenses mercy and grace in response to prayer. That's the mechanism. As we express this family relationship that John Fernandez talked about in chapter 2, that Christ has brought us together as family and calls us brothers, well, we receive grace and mercy through expressing that family relationship in prayer, speaking to Him, reflecting His will, praising Him in our prayers, bringing our needs to Him and our requests. We need to pray. We need to keep reminding ourselves of that, don't we? We can find all kinds of reasons not to pray. We can forget praying. And having done that, we tell ourselves that God won't hear us because there's something terribly wrong with us, because it's our fault that we haven't done it. We need to just do it sometimes, don't we? Just say, well, okay, I'm going to pray. Whatever's gone wrong, whatever I haven't done for the last few days, I'm going to pray. We need to do it. We must do it. If you want persuading of that, look at the link between verses 14 and 16, how 14 ends and 16 begins. Because 15 is this encouragement, gives a reason for something, the reason for verse 16. But if you pull that reason out and then just finish, read the end of verse 14 and the beginning of 16, we get this. Let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. Let us then approach the throne of grace with confidence. You see how the two things are linked logically. There's the 15 is the encouragement to pray, but it's hold to the faith, pray. So we need to pray. And if we need to start praying, or if we need to restart praying, well, let's set ourselves reasonable goals, 5 minutes a day, and go from there and build it up if that's what we need to do to pray regularly to get our prayer life going. Because we need to do it, because that's the way that Christ dispenses grace and mercy that we need. He says also, he says, pray, approach the throne of grace, but he says approach with confidence. The great high priest has opened a way to God, and he is ready, willing, and able to minister to us. So approach with confidence. It's all been opened up. It's all been done. There's no hindrance. So come, and come boldly, as we sung earlier. And I think this is there's some helpful material in this passage if we want to progress in our prayer life, as surely we should. Of course, we want to develop our prayer life in the light of biblical prayers and teaching and learn to reflect God's will and priorities. And isn't something of the high priestness of Christ, his high priesthood, helpful for part of our praying life? That he is sympathetic, he sympathizes, he represents, he deals gently. And isn't that something we want to reflect in our prayers for one another and the people we know? To sympathize in their position, to deal gently, to get alongside them in our prayers and understand where they are, represent them before the throne of God. We are priests of God, as we thought earlier on in our series in 1 Peter. And part of that ministry must be to become compassionate prayers, reflecting the compassionate priesthood of our Lord Jesus Christ. So there is a compassionate priesthood. Thirdly, pointing the wrong way, and we'll do this quickly, Christ's priesthood is a submissive priesthood. A submissive priesthood. We're having a day of submission, aren't we, if you were here this morning? And perhaps in 1 Peter, two or three weeks on submission. But Christ was a submissive priest. He was appointed by the Father. We find that in verses 4 to 6. And the writer quotes a couple of Old Testament prophecies which declare Christ's role as the great high priest. He was dependent on the Father at the beginning of verse 7, or most of verse 7. We read, during the days of Jesus' life on earth, he offered up prayers and petitions with loud cries and tears to the one who could save him from death. By the way, does that remind you of times in your prayer life? Praying with, struggling with God and praying with anguish. Did you think there was something wrong with you that you felt like that? Isn't it encouraging to see Christ as a man praying to God and relying on him with loud cries and tears? We perhaps think of Gethsemane here, particularly his prayer in Gethsemane, the one who could save him from death. But the fact that it says, during the days of Jesus' life on earth, I think suggests that this is a characteristic of his prayer life in general. He was always dependent on his Father, and he expressed himself in this very powerful way. He realized his weakness, he realized his need for the Father's help, and he faced many difficulties and had an extraordinarily demanding ministry, and he expressed it all to his Father in this powerful and emotional way. He prayed to the one who could save him from death, not so much the physical aspect of death, of course, but the prospect of being the sin bearer. So he was dependent on the Father, and he was reverent to the Father. And we read at the end of verse 7, he was heard because of his reverent submission, submitting to the Father's will. And finally, he was obedient to the Father. Verse 8, although he was a son, he learned obedience from what he suffered. Now, obedience came through suffering. He made atonement and obedience to the Father's will. He learned obedience. Does that surprise you? Perhaps think of Jesus being God and think, well, he doesn't need to learn anything. Why did he ever need to learn anything? But he learned obedience. There's a sense, I think, of in his human nature, he was learning as he grew up. But I think it's more than that, that as each new challenge came up in his ministry, a new level of obedience and commitment to the Father's will was required. He went further and further beyond what was required of him, or not further, beyond. He was more and more was required of him, and more beyond what a human could do without help was required from him. He was progressively required to give himself and sacrifice of himself, and he learned obedience progressively, step by step. Not that he was disobedient. It's just there was another thing to be obedient to, another thing and another thing. And he learned to be obedient moment by moment to the Father's will. And in all these things, Christ sets the pattern of discipleship and priesthood to God, doesn't he? In appointed by God, well, we can say, well, we're called by God to be Christians, being dependent on the Father, reverent towards the Father, obedient to the Father, thoroughly submissive. Is that the pattern of our discipleship? Well, that's the pattern that Christ set as the great high priest. This is the pattern of living that brought us into the family and gives so much to us, and we ought to copy it and reflect it in our lives and learn those lessons of submission that we're thinking about in 1 Peter just at the moment. So there's a submissive priesthood and finally a perfect priesthood. Because having learned obedience from what he suffered, verse 9, once made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him. He was made perfect. It's a phrase that we've already met. If you turn back to chapter 2 and verse 10, the writer says, in bringing many sons to glory, it was fitting that God, for whom and through whom everything exists, should make the author of their salvation perfect through suffering. So not just the idea of perfection, but perfection through suffering. Reinforcing, I think, the idea that the work of salvation that Jesus brought about was complete. It was finished. It was indeed, in my grandfather's phrase, the finished work of the great high priest. He had been made perfect, and through suffering, his temptations, his suffering, his death. And he became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him. Aren't those wonderful words? I'm not going to talk about them a lot, there's such a contrast there, isn't it? And if we want to look back as Jews and say, well, wasn't it better in the old days? But this is eternal salvation, not just forgiveness, not just atonement for this year, eternal salvation. What about us? If we look to some other source of hope, how long does it satisfy? How long does it help? How long will it last? This is eternal salvation for all who obey him. And finally, just this reference once again to being designated by God to be high priest in the order of Melchizedek. We'll find out more about Melchizedek as we go on through Hebrews. But this is God's spiritual priesthood. He once set up an earthly priesthood, accrediting Aaron as the high priest, and all Aaron's descendants were high priests in turn. But this is a spiritual priesthood, and Christ is an eternal high priest, bringing eternal salvation. Which then brings us back, actually, to where we started, isn't it? The reflections we began with, there had to be a high priest. There has to be a high priest. We need a high priest, and it is Christ. And the Christ, the great high priest, has brought salvation to his people. He's been designated by the Father, the great high priest, for all time. He ministers as a high priest, and it will go on forever. And so he continually ministers mercy and grace to his people as we pray continually. And isn't this all the more reason, putting this passage back in its context in Hebrews, to hold firmly to the faith? There's been the threats of the previous chapters of what will go wrong if you wander away, and it's terrible. This is a positive reason. This is what Christ has done. This is what the Father has done for you. He's given you a great high priest who has done everything in the past, who continues to do everything you need and more now. Why look back? Why look away? We come to the great high priest for salvation and for gracious help every day. We come to him for help with what we might think of as the minutiae, the small things of life. The things that we think we might not be bothered with, he helps us. We come to him in the worst trials and pain that we can undergo and have undergone, and he helps. And he keeps helping, and he keeps our hearts, so that one day we will live with him as the great high priest in heaven. Well, as we've reflected on these things, let's just pray to our God and give thanks for our